Bonjour à toutes et tous, vous écoutez First Print, votre podcast comics préféré pour une nouvelle émission du format Super Friends. C'est le podcast qui va à la rencontre des personnes qui font vivre la pop culture et la culture comics par leur travail. Et aujourd'hui, on est super content de recevoir dans le podcast, et peut-être en vidéo, Lorenzo De Felici, pour la sortie relativement récente de Chroma aux éditions Delcourt. C'est un artiste qu'on avait déjà reçu il y a quelques années, donc qu'on est vraiment super content de réaccueillir pour parler notamment de Chroma. On a abordé un petit peu aussi votre Rivals forcément, et donc après cette introduction et le générique, on va se retrouver en anglais pour discuter de bande dessinée à l'évidence. So now that my quick introduction in French is finished, thank you for being here, Lorenzo. It's really a pleasure to have you here on our podcast.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So since we already did an interview, like I said, like 5 years ago, but maybe some people are discovering your work today, or maybe just by listening to this podcast. So briefly, could you just introduce yourself a little bit? Who are you, Lorenzo? What are you doing for a living?
Okay, I'm a comic artist, basically. I started working in the industry like something like 15 years ago or even more than that. I don't want to think about how much time has passed because I don't want to feel old. And I started as a colorist, and then I went on and also worked as an artist, and lately I also with Chroma was my debut as a writer too, and I worked with in the French market, in a little bit in the Italian market, and mostly now since 2015 or so I work for the American market, and I work alongside Robert Kirkman that I was co-creator with him and artist of a book called Oblivion Song that started coming out, I think, in 2018 or something. Yeah. And then, we went 36 issues and then it stopped. It was over. And then I did Chroma. And now I'm still working with Robert Kirkman on another project called Void Rivals. And that's it.
This is quite huge. Are you getting tired of drawing?
No, absolutely. If I could get tired of drawing, I wouldn't do this job. This job is just, draw every day. And if you don't enjoy it, you should be doing something else.
But do you remember at what time you decided that you were going to draw for a living? Were you always attracted by telling stories with drawings?
Yes, it started pretty early, and I remember that my first, I had a real connection with drawing, because I remember that when I was at my grandma's, she liked to play with drawings, and I was always following her and trying to keep up with her, and she made me draw on her kitchen table, and it was really, really, a very bonding experience for me. And since then I started liking and reading comics, and I understood that my love for stories and my love for drawing could, collide in something which is comic art. And since then, I didn't have any kind of doubt about what I was going to do and what I was going to be in my life. I just knew that I was going to be a comic artist, and I was pretty, not very responsible about it. Like I never had a plan B or anything. Like I was just, okay, no, I'm doing that, and very obtusely I went on and tried to persevere, and I was lucky enough to then make it, but I never had any other kind of will. I just wanted to do this and worked very hard to do this, and also I was lucky.
Okay, but you could have chosen another path, even in terms of storytelling. Like you could have done animation, or maybe video games, or storyboards for movies industry. What is special about comics in terms of storytelling to you?
Oh, it's a nice question. The important thing for me, one of the most fascinating things about comics, is how easy. Relatively easy it is to make them, because with animation or a movie you have hundreds of people involved, and a lot, there's a chain of productivity that is very long, and so the space between your idea and the fruition of your idea by the reader or the viewer is very long, it's very, you know, very large. In comics, especially now with internet, and like I'm giving away my age saying that, but like the space between whatever you come up with and you know the connection with the reader is virtually nothing, and that really fascinates me. And even for example in Chroma, while the first issues were coming out, I was in the US, it came out in 4 issues, so in 4 parts. And when the first and the second part were already being read by the readers, I was drawing the fourth issue. So that gives you the idea of how quickly you can do it and how immediate it is. And also in the, you know, in the comic landscape, you can also be able to be on your own doing things, you know, which is not something that you can do in movie making, maybe in animation, but then the times get really, really huge. The timing between, you know, doing it and the viewer viewing it. And yeah, so... I mean, I really like how very immediate it is, how you can change your style, how you can use the page and the interaction between the reader and your work at your advantage. You can do stuff in comics that is very difficult to do in any other kind of media. And that is really, for me, it's really fascinating.
So you mentioned in the the forewords in the French edition of Chroma that it was originally intended to be a project for the European market. So can you elaborate a little bit about the origins of Chroma?
Yeah, as I wrote in the beginning, the project was I was working for the French market, and so very naturally I thought that this idea of mine would have worked in the European market. And so I started knocking on doors of editors and publishers, and almost nothing came out of it. Like, it was kind of frustrating. I was working as a colorist in at that time, and I was trying to, you know, to start working as an artist. I already did a bit of work as an artist with Draka, always for the French market. But then I went back to being a colorist because nobody was interested in my work as an artist. So I was trying to double down and not only propose myself as an artist, but also as a writer. And nobody was taking it, basically. And so...
Great times.
Yeah, I mean, it was a little bit frustrating, but I wasn't like crying or pulling my hair or anything. I was just... kind of, you know, bummed, because I thought that, what I'm doing is not interesting, you know, evidently. And so at that moment, I started another job as an artist for the French market. So I was kind of reassured, at least by that, like, okay, at least I can be an artist there. But as I started working for this comic, which was Infinity 8 or Infinity 8, Robert Kirkman sent me an email asking if I wanted to work with him, and so of course I said yes. And the whole project Kurama was kind of put, I put it aside, like, okay, maybe one day, you know, like, who knows, I will go back to it. And so as I was closing the Oblivion Song chapter around, you know, it was, I had like a 1 year left of this project, I was like, okay, let me try, you know, to do Kurama, but in the American market. Because in the end, even though I'm from Europe and everything, I grew up with comics. And I was working in comics, and I kind of felt it was my vibe. And I was like, okay, let me try there. And sure enough, it was instantly approved by Robert. I gave the project to Robert, and he was immediately on board with that. And in the meantime, you know, several years passed between my you know, me trying to sell Kurama to the French market and me trying to sell Kurama to the US market. And so in the meantime, I, you know, grew up as a human and as an artist, and the project grew up with me. And it was initially a different project. It was more, you know, more naive, a little bit more young adult maybe. And what came out in the end, and what I presented to the American market, and what Kurama is now, is a more adult kind of story. And I, you know, I managed to convey a little bit more a serious message throughout the comic. And I mean, in that way, I think that me being you know, rejected by the publisher in the beginning was kind of a good thing in perspective, because it gave me the opportunity to work more on the project and come out with something that I'm very proud of. And surely I would be, I'm more proud of whatever came out now of what could have came out, you know, years ago.
You think that the proto Kurama that could have been like 7 years ago would be,
I don't know,
too different, or maybe that the actual Kurama is better than what you had in mind 7 years ago?
I think that it's more, you know, the more you go on in this job, the more you feel sure of yourself, and of your voice, or whatever, you know, you are trying to do, or you are trying to say with your job. And so the Kurama that came out now, it wouldn't have been possible, but that, you know, maybe 10 years ago, but almost. Because then I wouldn't have the courage to say some of the things that I said in the comic. Because, not because I wasn't sure of them, but because I always felt very unsure, personally, I'm not a very assertive person. I'm always doubting about everything that I think. And so I always try to shy away from any kind of definitive, affirmation, anything very, I'm not sure about anything. And I wanted to convey this uncertainty also through the comic, but it wasn't that immediate. Absolutely, it wouldn't have been possible 10 years ago. And so I think that it would have been different. I don't know if it would have been better or worse, but I don't know, like, everything is relative, you know? So maybe it would have been more successful, but I wouldn't have been proud of what I said. I don't know.
But even though the two projects are different, there's still like some a basic, which was Chroma as a character, this young girl, and also you wanted to use the colors really in a narrative way. Why is it so important to you to go about that way with the colors?
Because I was always very frustrated whenever I worked as a colorist. You know, are you also an artist or are you working on the other side?
You personally? Yeah. I'm a journalist. I'm not an artist.
Okay. So, just because otherwise I would have included you in this thing. But whenever you, as an artist, you know, whenever you read any kind of review of something that you worked on for a long time, there is a part of you that wants a little bit of recognition, like a little bit of, hey, you did a great job or something. Like, personally, I never wanted any kind of fame or success or anything, but I just wanted my efforts to be recognized, you know, like it should be in a way. Everybody's effort should be recognized in any way, I think. And as a colorist, so I started as a colorist, and as a colorist, that part of my job was the most frustrating part of, because every time that I read the review about a comic that I worked on as a colorist, there was always like 80% of it was about the story, maybe sometimes 20% was about the art, and nothing about the color, or sometimes there was like one line like saying, oh, good, like the art team was very good, like you know. And so that's really little recognition for a whole lot of job, for a whole lot of work, and in my opinion very important kind of work, because it's difficult to, you know, to pinpoint whenever an artist or a colorist is good, because, you know, beauty is subjective and everything. But in comics, it's you have the tools to understand if an artist did a good job or a great job or a bad job or anything. And so out of this frustration came out the idea of, okay, I want to do a comic where whenever I read any review of it, nobody can't, you know, say anything about the colors. You have to name the colorist, or at least acknowledge the color of the comic whenever you have you write a review of Chroma, because it is about colors. So out of this frustration, I was like, you know what? I want to do a comic where you have to mention the color in the review. And so out of that came out Chroma. Of course, the more emotional part of me, since again I worked as a colorist for a long time, and I also taught color in academies and everything, and I studied a lot of you know, things about color, and I understand how important it is in the storytelling part of comics. You know, it's really, really important. It's a very pivotal element, pivotal tool in comics. And so I wanted also to show how a little bit in a more, you know, direct and explicit way, how color can be a part of the storytelling of a story, and how it can play a role as a character in a story. And so instead of doing it in a very, you know, subliminal way, like it's usually used, like color is always used by great colorists or great cinematographers in cinema as a subtle way of conveying information. Like, I don't know if you know about, for example, in Jaws, the movie Jaws from Steven Spielberg, there is a great use of color there, and not everybody understands it or even knows that, but there is a subtle way that color have been used in that movie. So every time that you are about to see the shark in Jaws, there is a yellow element in the frame, So every time, so you like Pavlov's dog, after a while, whenever you see yellow, you kind of start to be unsettled because your brain knows that something is about to happen. And that's incredible because you don't know that. It's like a ghost track that you cannot see or cannot follow it in the beginning. And it's very awesome. But again, it's not that easy to spot. So again, with Chrome, I just wanted to celebrate the role of color in storytelling in the most interesting way that I could.
And was it difficult for you to have the settling of the how you would use colors in terms of structural elements? Because it's not just a gimmick, because we have the pay city the humanity is inside and they literally fear everything that's colored. But it's not just a gimmick to just say, okay, we have these characters in black and white and the rest will be in colors. There's a Chroma is a literally using colors to communicate with the giant reptiles in the end. So how did these ideas came up to just use the colors as a really a structural elements and not just visual?
The way that color plays a part in the story is actually the first element that I started building the story on. Like, in the very beginning, I wanted to have something about color, and what I lacked was the idea that allowed me to use color not in a, like you said, as a gimmick. And so the first characters that came out that started Chroma were actually the lizards, like the huge reptiles, because I was, okay, I need something that, I want like a monster that is connected with colors, and that from that part, from that idea sprouted everything else. And it's the first time that I write something longish like this, and so I could see for the first time how sometimes ideas dictate the pacing of the story or whatever happens in the story more than whatever you come up with. Like, once you have the elements in the story and you push the first tile of the domino, and then everything else starts falling down in the right way, and you have almost no control. And that's how Chroma was born. Like, I needed an element of disruption inside of this community, and that was it. And in the beginning, like in the French, in the French, version of the story, the one that I started with, Chroma was more feisty, and she was more like a rebel, like, hey, yeah, well, it's not right, or more combative, more But then the character was, in this new version, I just started thinking about how somebody would behave in that specific situation. And so, for example, I read a couple of books written by was really sad books, but written by girls that were abducted when they were like 5, and then they lived like 20 years in captivity and like prisoners. And I tried to understand more about the psychology of such a burden, put to your like the guilt that it's that everybody tries to attach to you, that we all feel, but in this case, of course, Chroma feels it even more, because it's a potential guilt. It's not a real guilt. It's a guilt that she's convinced about. And so, yeah, everything was different in the beginning, because whenever you come up with a story, you want your character, your protagonist to be cool and, you know, actiony and kicking ass and everything. But then the story would not have been sincere or, you know, relatable if that was the case. And so that's also the way that the story changed, and everything that came out of it was the difference between the first version of Chroma and this version of Chroma. So I just tried now to be more realistic and more honest about whatever was happening. I don't think it's a crude comic or anything, but I think it has like parts.
It's quite violent.
Yeah, it's violent, but I never wanted to be gratuitous with violence. I just tried to convey that some violence that is not explicit, that is more psychological, will come out somehow, somewhere in the story, and it's not, you know, justified, because I don't think that violence is ever justified, but it's, you can understand where that violence is coming from, and that's, you know, that's part of the thing that I wanted to say about that.
But still, there's quite some intensity even with violence, because we still have like a panel where when Chroma is just having the beheaded head of our enemy, and it's still a little girl. So this is quite a very violent imagery. So you didn't have any restraints about what you would show and what you would do with such a young character?
No, absolutely not. Like when I presented my synopsis of the project to Skybound, the only thing that they weren't convinced about was the ending.
We'll speak about that later, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, so I won't talk in depth about it, but nowhere else came any kind of restriction for me. And I think that it's because I'm not a violent person, and I don't like gratuitous violence, or I don't like to, you know, show violence just because it's cool or it's interesting. But, for example, the scene that you are talking about, for me, is the breaking point of the character, where she gives in to whatever it's been building up in her for years and years and years and years. And her realization of what kind of injustice she's been, you know, subjected to comes out like a tsunami, and that sequence, that scene for me is the moment where the dam completely breaks and starts flooding everything. And so I hope that it's not taken like anything is taken like the justification of you know, being violent or hurting anybody, because I think it's always wrong. But, you know, sometimes frustration builds up, you know.
Yeah, it's a progression of the character. But even though that it also fits in with the tonality of the whole story, and the fact that you also have you're doing some shock moments, and that was also one of my questions, because when you just read the first issue, so there was this cliffhanger with the apparent death of Death, and in any, and I remember because I read it in single issues before the French edition, and so in any regular American comic book, you would know that beginning of issue 2, Death would still be alive by some mm-hmm. way, that it would be saved. So no, you're going full trauma in this one, and it really impressed me that you would go full on okay, the main character from first issues won't survive at all, even if you can still see him afterwards in a different way, and I don't know if that's you had to take a rough decision to just kill one of your main character just at the end of first issue.
The main inspiration for that for me was Psycho, the movie from Alfred Hitchcock. I love that in that movie, he you start with a character and you go along with the character for like 15 minutes, and then spoiler alert for whoever didn't see a Psycho, like close your ears. After the first 15 minutes or so, the protagonist gets killed and we switch to another character. And that's always been mind-blowing for me. Like considering also when Psycho came out, it was revolutionary. And I always wanted to do something like that. But in the same time, here in Chroma, I had other kind of, you know... I had the main need in Chroma was to, I wanted her to be alone, but it's very difficult whenever you have a lonely character to make dialogue happen, yeah, to show the growing up, the evolution, the arc of the character. It's very tricky and it can be very boring because you can, you know, start to show stuff, but trying to, you know, convey specific and complicated things with just images, and it's very tricky. It can be beautiful, but it can also be very boring. So I wanted to have her to have somebody besides her. And in fact, in the French version of the story, she met like a weird character, like a anthropomorphic mole or like weird stuff, so that she had somebody to talk to. And in this version, I was like, okay, I want her to have somebody, but at the same time, I think that I want her to be alone. And so the only way to do that was to make so that the character that we see in the first issue becomes just a voice in her head, and it's the first voice in her miserable life that said something nice to her and put like the seed of doubt in her, like maybe you're not bad, you know, that's all he says basically. And that small seed of doubt grows to something more and more and more, you know, and in the end, it, you know, it brings the character to this arc. And so in the whole progression of the character, I wanted her to confront with this kind of voice in her head that she doesn't give her any kind of new information. There is no revelation or no additional information given by this kind of voice in her head, but it's the voice that reminds her of you. Maybe you shouldn't do that. Like nobody's saying you're free, you know, you shouldn't do that, and you shouldn't be driven by any kind of traumatic thing that you had in the past. You should move forward and be free and be yourself and be good. And that's, you know, that's the voice that everybody has in their head, because in our life we always had the guys and the ones that were on our side and the ones that tried to undermine us, and that sometimes it's yourself, like you start to trying to undermine yourself. And so I wanted her to have this kind of fight within her without it being too, you know, cheesy or literal.
Yeah. There's also something maybe that changed between the French version and the final version. It's in terms of pacing, because writing for the European market and writing for the American market is not the same thing. So I guess you also have to redo the whole narrative structures in terms of getting the story in four chapters, which are quite big chapters in terms of page counts. It's not 20 page issues. Was it hard for you to work like that? I guess you had the experience with all the Oblivion Song issues you did with Robert.
Actually, in the French version didn't go as far as a whole chapters of the story. In the French version, I just had sample pages and a very, you know, in-depth synopsis of the story, but I didn't lay out any kind of any story. Like, I didn't have pages and pages of one after the other. I just had random sample pages. And also, I had a friend of mine, that a writer, that helped me writing the synopsis for the first version. When I went to the American version, I restarted from scratch, and I restarted from the core elements of the story, that were the color, chroma, the lizards, and everything. And there I started drawing the chapters and doing the layouts and the sketches for every issue. And actually, it wasn't hard at all. At least, in fact, it was like a relief for me having to work in the American format, because the problem with, you know, with whenever you come out with something creative is that if you don't have boundaries, if you don't have fences within, you can work, you can feel lost because there are endless possibilities, you know. Whenever you, I started working in the American market, I saw that there is a structure to every issue. So you have the beginning, you have some kind of, you know, something going on, like a certain amount of pages is gets the plot to go forward, and then you have some action scene, and then another bit of plot, and then you have the cliffhanger, and then, you know, the issue is done. And since you have this kind of structure, you can put whatever element you have in mind in these slots, and the issue is pretty, you know, you can build it pretty easily. It's way more, you know, easy than having like a bunch of pages randomly, and you don't know where things should happen and where things should stop, and when they should, you know, speed up or slow down. In that that way, the American structure gave me like a skeleton, an infrastructure of, you know, where I could put my, my the elements that I had in mind into, and that was very helpful. And of course, working with Robert for many years helped me, because I saw how, you know, not that I studied the scripts, it just came natural. Like, after a while, you start to internalize some kind of, you know, progression or motion and rhythm and pacing. And it, I just had to, you know, to be as natural as I could in the first issue, in the issues. And, you know, I knew where I should have put some action and where I should have slowed down and things like that. Like, instinctively, you know.
Because I think I've read in an interview that you didn't write any scripts. You were directly doing the rough and the storyboards on pages. So that I guess you had the whole breakthrough through in your head, or?
Yeah, I mean, every issue, I had a breakdown of whatever I wanted to say in that issue and where that issue should stop. And so I had like, okay, this happens, and then you have the cliffhanger here. And so when I was layouting stuff, I was like, okay, so this scene should take like 2 or 3 pages, this scene 5 pages, this scene 2 pages, and so on and so forth. And I started drawing, and I mean, before drawing, I write the dialogues, like a very, you know, rough approximation of the dialogues. And then I start doing the thumbnails. So very small drawings to just to map out the issue. And then I put the two things together, and I put the dialogues in the thumbnails, and I go a little bit more in details in the thumbnails, and I do the layouts for the pages. And then I change the dialogue according to the drawing, and the drawing according to the dialogue. And at that point, I have, you know, a rough idea of how the issue will be structured. And from then, I just, you know, just refine things and I fix small details. Maybe I lose a page or two, or I add a page or two here and there. And in the end, you know, I have something that, you know, I don't know, because I always drawn everything that I wrote. So it's very difficult for me to write a script, like just words. For me, I have to visualize whatever I'm doing, and I have to read it while I'm laying out. Like, I lay out three pages, and then I go back and I read them. And if there is something that I doesn't add up, or it's too, oh, here it's too slow. Here I should add like a close up of a reaction. Here I should wait for a moment, maybe add one panel to make the page breathe a little bit more. But it's just instinctive, because, you know, when you read enough comics, after a while you have like a sixth sense about these things. And when it works for me, I think it's okay. That's done, you know, and I should just go and really draw it. And which is, in a way, the way that I always worked. Like, I always try to do something that I would love to read, you know, and that I would enjoy. And that's been, I'm very lucky, again. I can't stress that enough, but that's always been my, you know, my North Star, you know, like, I should do something that I'm entertained by, because otherwise I don't enjoy doing it. And I will lose love for it. And if you lose love whenever you're doing something artistical, it shows, you know, comes out as a crooked or not very sincere. And I turned 40 now, like a couple of days ago, I turned 41.
And so you just said how old you are.
Yeah, I know.
You were trying so hard not to mention it, but...
I'm not talking about physical age. I'm talking about mental age. Like, physically, I turned 41 the other day. And, I, you know, after a while, you start saying, okay, if it takes like 1 year or a couple of years to develop a project, and I won't be immortal, eternal, how many projects do I have still, you know, in my future? And you start to say, okay, I should work from now on, I should work, try to work at least just in projects that I really care about, because otherwise it's not worth it. It's a lot of job doing everything, so it should be worth it.
Okay, there's also, I think, a real statement about lies in this book, because we discover at some point that Chroma is not really the daughter of a color god, that the whole color and the whole myth that has gone into the past is just a myth or a lie. Do you think that you're saying something about humanity and how humanity covers behind lies to justify their actions?
Yeah, absolutely. That's what I wanted to say in the end. And I don't think that lies are inherently bad. I just think that some lies, whenever you lie to control, that's a bad lie. That's something that you shouldn't do, and that's something that nobody should allow. And in the comic, I just tried to, and for me, the answer to everything is communication. It's to, you know, to not to trust blindly anything, but to try and communicate with whatever you're trying to, you fear, or whatever you are trying to avoid, is to go there and communicate and try to build a bridge of language. And from there, everything can be resolved, everything. But if you don't do this, if you don't do that because somebody else says that you cannot do it, or you cannot communicate with them because they're lizard, they're going to eat you, and you shouldn't even try to be there and face them. You should just fear and go away and you know, hide somewhere. That's something that I don't like, and that's something that, you know, again, I'm never sure about almost anything, but there are some things that I believe in, and communication is definitely one of them.
But it's really not weird, but like it really has a particular political sound when you read it, when you read Chroma in 2022, because even though you imagined like five years ago the American or the final version, still, because we have a city with people like fearing the outside, the others, the colors, and when you live in Europe, and I guess you've been following what's happening in your country, in Italy, and we also have it in France and in other countries of Europe, it really seems to be really accurate about just what's going on with humanity. Did you anticipate this, or was it something conscious from you?
No, because you don't have to, like, it's always actual. Whatever, you know, whenever you read something about humanity, like in this case, it's always something that you can relate to, because the news in Europe are not that different from the news in Europe 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 15 years ago or so. It's always the same, because we are human and we make the same mistakes over and over and over. And I'm not that hopeful, but I try to do my part. But, you know, I don't think that any kind of message of like this would ever get old, because it's always the same reality. And one of the reasons why I like stories is because they are not just there to entertain you, but sometimes when you're lucky, you stumble upon a story that talks about something that you know while talking about something that you don't know. So, for example, in sci-fi or fantasy, you are talking about weird creatures, aliens, and future, past, whatever. But you are always we as humans are always talking about humanity. And for me, Chroma is this. It's like a fable. It's like a story where I talk about something really weird. But in the end, you can relate to whatever I'm saying in a different way and attach the message to any kind of problem that you have. Like for me, there are some things that inspired me while I was writing it, like socially. But, you know, as soon as I wrote them, I was like, yeah, but this could be intended also applied to this, or it could be applied to this or that. And that, I mean, the more universal you are, the better for me, at least.
I also have like a question about the ending, because we understood before that Chroma has reached a breaking point, so she's quite obligated to act in a way, but still she breaks the city's walls, she kills people in her action, and the boys at the end are stating that she did some harm to people that were completely innocent. So this is quite a very immoral situation, or it really questions our morality. What's your point about where do you stand about Chroma's actions?
I reject any kind of violence. So I don't justify whatever my characters do, because they're not, you know, real people. They don't need justification. But it was just a way. Between all the other things that I'm trying to say, it's also that if you push enough good people, and if you teach even like to anybody, even to a kid, that violence is the answer, and that you don't have any kind of choice, and you cannot speak, or you cannot face or confront anything that is scary to you or to whatever you are part of, you will teach them something that will eventually come back to you in a harmful way. And so in a way, if you say to somebody that, oh, you are going to hurt somebody, you need to feel guilty because you are the bringer of destruction and et cetera, et cetera, that will be, in time, there will be a self-fulfilling prophecy, because you will teach them, you will put in their mind something that will eventually come out, which is not a justification for the violence in any way, but it's just to say you can't expect people to behave and to do the right thing always if you are doing the wrong thing. You should teach by example. You shouldn't throw the stone and then hide the hand that threw it. You should be responsible for whatever you teach and whatever you communicate to anybody. And if you reject that kind of responsibility in name of some kind of belief or some kind of agenda, you can expect something to go wrong. And it's wrong, but I mean, the responsibility doesn't lay just in the hands of whoever does the violence sometimes. The responsibility should be taken by whoever is a part of the system, because the violence doesn't come out, spontaneously. Violence is like a seed that you plant into people, and then when it comes out, you can't be, surprised by that. Like, it's the thing that you were throwing in the ground.
I had also another way of viewing the ending or just the story, because I really at some point saw it as an ecological fable in which trauma would be nature. So because the humanity is also protecting herself against nature, and then when. When what we have today, when you have dramatic rains or storms, people get hurt also, and so you could see Chroma as the embodiment of just nature, just throwing back at humanity for how they treated her. I don't know if I'm completely wrong or not.
No, you're not wrong, but it's because I wasn't talking about a specific topic. I was talking about humanity, and humanity behaves the same way with immigrants, with nature, with anything that they they don't want to face. They don't want to take responsibility, or they don't want to work on anything that disrupts their status quo is something that they have to, push away and reject until it blows in their face, and then they say, oh, but it's not our fault. Oh, it's their fault. We have, for example, here in my hometown, we have an invasion of boars, wild pigs. Not an invasion, but every public park has, there is boars there and things like that. And we are trying to understand how to push them away from the parks and things like that. Forgetting that our city and the latest, buildings in our city and the latest construction plants in our city took away a lot of land that belong to the wild pigs, and now we have them in our parks, and the moms are going like, oh, my baby, there is a boar there, how is it possible, it's unacceptable. But then, I mean, we kind of took their land, and they don't know where to go, so where is our responsibility in that, and that's one example. But I wasn't talking about the boars in my hometown in Chroma. But you can say that it applies to that also, because again, the more you are talking about something abstract like chroma, the more you can apply the same kind of story to, sadly, to a lot of things.
And I also read in another interview that you might have still have ideas about how the world functions, about what happened to humanity, why they go almost extinct. Maybe there would be other people in other cities. Is it something that you're thinking of returning to the world of chroma?
So I thought about it a little bit because you know, just like, again, I try to do the things that I enjoy, and since I enjoyed writing chroma, I would enjoy writing more of that. But at the same time, I don't want to write chroma 2 because, you know, just because it's been good drawing the first one. Because I like this story for me comes out of, you know, an idea that I had, a message that I wanted to say. And if I don't have anything like that, I don't like to work on it. If I don't have something that pushes my idea forward, like, okay, it's worth it, you know, like you're trying to say something and go on and do it, build upon it. If I don't have that, I'm not interested in doing in this that just because it's fun. I want to have like a story that it's worth telling, and if it happens to be a story that can be set in the world of chroma, I will definitely do it because I had fun doing it. But like right now, I'm working on another story that doesn't have anything to do with chroma, and I'm trying to go in a very different direction because, you know, I'm excited about telling a new thing. I don't want to go back to the same thing. I'm excited to try and write different things and you know, and challenge myself in a way.
And the project you're speaking about is something that you are going to write also? It's not Void Rivals
No. Void Rivals. When I say that I'm developing a project, is something that I'm also writing. Void Rivals is like I'm just the artist there, so I do the design and the art, but that's it. And no, I'm talking about another story that I'm developing and I'm very excited about, and I always think about how to solve problems in it and how to go ahead. And I already wrote a couple of issues, but I need to go back to it and work it a little bit more. But hopefully, you know, it will come out in the future. I can't say when because I don't even know. But just to say that I'm working on something that is completely different, or maybe it's completely the same, I don't know. But at least on the surface, it's completely different.
Okay, so, well, we'll talk about that project maybe another time when it's out. Yeah, we can wait, and we still have to let you actually do the work, otherwise you can't advance on it. So thank you so much, Lorenzo, for being with us and for answering this question. It was really great to have a little chat about chroma with you. Thank you.
Thank you, man.